What's that you say? You're discouraged over the way nonsense dominates our political process? You're annoyed at the way redistricting always benefits the party in power? Frustrated the legislature is always in gridlock? You have the power to change all that. Good morning. I'm Steve Heimel, and this is not a political ad. Welcome to Talk of Alaska. Today, what we could accomplish with a constitutional convention. Our statewide phone number, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, a local call in Anchorage of 550-8422, email talk@alaskapublic.org. Talk of Alaska, live and statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com. And by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Well, when you're in the news media for a while in Alaska, you discover that every 10 years, Alaskans get to vote on whether or not they should have a constitutional convention. And that time has come around again, and somebody that has been watching for it is a former attorney general who joins us on the program today and urges us to take this proposition seriously this time around, John Havelock. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, John.
Good to be here, Steve.
John, you've written a book called Let's Get It Right. It just hit the shelves in the bookstores. Let's Get It Right, Protect the Permanent Fund Dividend, Get Corporations Out of Our Elections, End Legislative Deadlock, and more. You get to vote. Why we need an Alaska Constitutional Convention. Why, that's almost an ad in itself. So you were essentially saying here we should take seriously what we could potentially do with a constitutional convention.
Yes, I do. And this is not to denigrate at all the original work of the Constitutional Fathers that wrote a constitution back in the territory. They were doing that in a context where they were trying to persuade the Congress to make Alaska a state, and they couldn't possibly have anticipated all the many things that have happened since then. Not the least of which is the wealth that is accumulated to Alaska. Nobody could have contemplated that at that time. There are also three Supreme Court decisions that have come down since then, one of which expanded the opportunities for democracy, a case called Reynolds against Sim, which said one person, one vote. And then we have two later cases that have impaired democracy, which one is Buckley against Valeo, which essentially said that money is speech. And then we've got the most recent one, Citizens United, which says that corporations are people for purposes of the First Amendment. Now, we can't change all Supreme Court decisions, but we can certainly rewrite our constitutional provisions in that area in order to maximize democracy. And I think the number one issue, it seems to me, that requires us to try a convention this year is because I do think that there's been a substantial deterioration in the quality of democracy in Alaska, as in the country, and the domination of money as over all other forms of political life seems to is only halfway there, and we need to stop it.
Well, the obvious question would be if money's already dominating a political process, why wouldn't money also dominate the Constitutional Convention?
I know that's a legitimate question to bring up. But, you know, one of the things that when I talk to people around, I talk to some, you know, fairly thinking people in the business community and in the university community and elsewhere. And a lot of them say, well, gee, if you had a convention, I would run, or I'd certainly think about running. So I think you're going to get a whole new sample of people being candidates who would not consider the regular political life because of the nature of the current political life, the commitment to living in Juneau, et cetera, and making your whole life being a politician, spending half your time raising money. And that's distasteful to a whole lot of people, and rightfully so. So I think you're going to get a different kind of person that's going to come forward, and I think there will be organized efforts to try to keep a convention in a situation where you've got strong, bright leadership, a lot of new leadership maybe from younger people, and people are not already very active in politics.
Well, I think we want to get pretty quickly here to the issue of what you could accomplish with a constitutional convention. And you certainly opened my eyes in this book, Let's Get It Right, to a lot of things we could potentially do. And I want to do that. But let's do a little procedural thing first, which is, how did the process actually work? Today is primary election day.
Right.
Alaskans listening to this have either already gone to the polls or are thinking about going to the polls later. They get confronted with a ballot, and it has all these things on it, right? And for instance, we all know there'll be some propositions at the end. Where on my ballot will this appear in November?
This is the general election ballot. It'll be Prop 1, shall there be a constitutional convention?
And will it say much more than that?
No, it's not. In fact, there's an amusing incident Red Boucher, when he was lieutenant governor,
Red Boucher. Why would it be Red Boucher? Of all the lieutenant governors we had.
he had put in a preface saying, as required by the Constitution, and shall there be. And it passed overwhelmingly, and it was challenged in court, and the vote was thrown out.
And it was all because he said, because the Constitution tells us we have to do this.
Yeah.
Well, so people vote yes or no. Let's say that your book persuaded people, or the idea got going around, and they said, we could do this or we could do that. Like, there could be a rallying point. Like, the permanent fund might be one, or a unicameral legislature might be one,
right,
or Overcoming Citizens United, something that would just galvanize people. Let's get this done. And so they mobilize, and they get a yes vote. Then what happens?
Well, the legislature needs to implement it, and, we're going to need a lot
of... It goes to the legislature?
Yes, it does. Well, it's a mandate, so if the legislature didn't do it, I've been asked this question, it's an interesting speculation, but if they didn't, then there are guidelines in the Constitution, and the court would mandate a constitutional convention if the legislature didn't live up to its responsibilities, which... given the record that they have accumulated over the last couple of years, is, I suppose, within the realm of possibility, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and sometimes our court can get a little spunky, too.
That's right.
it is true that so I can see what happened. All right, so the legislature would no doubt huff and puff and probably accommodate it, but they'd try and spin it as they were doing it, and they would. But how much freedom do they have to create this? I mean, is there, for instance, you said, well, I think people would be motivated to run for a constitutional convention, not the usual run of politicians,
that's
but
right,
other people as well. And
right.
But would they have any chance? I mean, how would the electoral process work to put together a constitutional convention? How long would they have to do it? Do we know any of this?
I think you're looking at a convention about 2 years out. So and I think that the legislature would get into it in the next session. Obviously, if it passed, not just myself, but people at the University's Institute for Social and Economic Research, people at the Fairbanks Universities, just as it was with the first convention, there'll be guidance, professional guidance coming from outside the state, from political scientists and social scientists who can say, well, this is how it's been done in other states, because this is not exactly unique. There have been several dozen conventions by other states over the years.
And you're kidding me.
Not as disastrous as you might think, given everybody thought that a convention would be taken over by crazies. I think probably the founding fathers thought that, just imagine it, I think I would have too, thought the general public was crazy back then. But but nonetheless, they still did put together a convention, and people picked some pretty good people to go to that convention. I think that would, as they did in 55-6 here in Alaska, and I think that would happen again.
One point that you made is that our constitutional convention was composed of wasn't truly representative of either the ruling class or of the, essentially it was people that were interested in selling statehood.
That's right. That was the, that's what it was about, although, and you're right, it wasn't you would call a ruling class. The main problem with the representation was there was only one Alaska Native, a fine gentleman, Frank Brachovich from down in Metlakatla, but he didn't know that much about what was going on in Inupiat country and so on. So I think that's one of the reasons to do it over. And if you look at the current preamble to the Constitution, you'll notice that it's all about pioneers, and it doesn't mention that, we used to have people living here before the pioneers came, you know. So I think that ought to be fixed. This is a matter of elementary justice.
Well, that brings up a really interesting point, because we all know that we have a subsistence standoff.
That's right.
People think of it as a gridlock, but it isn't really. It's actually a dynamic process. If you look at it over the years, once the McDowell decision came down, the state has slowly been losing control
that's
over
exactly,
subsistence.
That's right. Yeah, McDowell and McDowell, a state Supreme Court, said that that the state law, which was intended to comply with federal law allowing for a rural preference, was unconstitutional. The category was too broad. I might add that my favorite, and I think most people's all-time favorite, Jay Rabinowitz, the Chief Justice, was a dissenter from that decision. But I think that the McDowell could be fixed in so that kind of a rural preference could be put back in, and maybe we could get peace on the reservation here again.
Well, how long would a constitutional convention have to take? I mean, you're talking about, you said, well, it wouldn't be the same kind of people necessarily that are in the legislature.
Right.
But if you look at a commitment beyond, say, that of a grand jury, you're probably talking about a commitment that people are hesitant to take up.
It'd be tough, but it's not year after year, and it's not going to be, campaigning year after year. And
so what do you think?
I think about 90 days would be my guess.
Oh, yeah.
It depends,
3 months. Kind of like a grand jury then.
Yeah. A lot of work has to be done in advance, but that's, I think there are the resources within the university community and other communities here, including, Rotaries and places like that, Chamber of Commerce, the various organizations that would have positions and perspectives.
Well, one of the most fun things about the book really is an introduction, some theoretical setting out about here's what we could accomplish, but mostly you take it section by section and say, look, here's what we could do about this, here's what we could do about that.
Right.
And you go through the whole state constitution. Now, this is thought to be one of the masterpieces of constitution, so why mess with it?
Well, I think it was a sales document back there and addressed to the Congress. And the main thing is look at all that's changed, and Jefferson commented on this in advocating for change, and that you don't ask a grown adult to wear the same clothes that he was given, the short pants that the male was given when he was a kid. So here's some lists of things they didn't know. They didn't know that Alaska would become rich. They didn't know anything about these three Supreme Court decisions that have come down. I think that probably a majority, to take that one, I think a majority of the delegates would have voted for a unicameral legislature, that is one chamber, not dividing it in a Senate, if they'd known that the Supreme Court was going to decide shortly thereafter that one person, one vote is the rule of constitutional representation. So, and indeed, the people of Alaska have voted on an advisory that they wanted a unicameral legislature, but obviously the legislature itself, which is a roadblock between the people and a constitutional convention or constitutional amendment, they were not interested in that at all because of the disruption it would mean in their individual careers. So, I think that's one of the major things that would change. They didn't know that Jay Hammond would have the wisdom to create a permanent fund. They didn't know there'd be a dividend. The dividend has no protection. It's subject to legislative whim, and I think that the dividend should become a part of our Constitution. They didn't know that public wealth would be followed by massive public corruption episodes. Because, you know, in those early days, hey, they were all honest people. Everybody knew what everybody else was doing anyway. And we didn't really have, anything coming close to that kind of scandal until the, what do they call themselves, the corrupt bastards and other things that were going on that I don't want to engage in that. So a lot of these people are still around. But you know, we've had some real problems, which it seemed to me suggests some constitutional change there. If we get the chance, I'd like to discuss a little bit about my concept of having an inspector general. We didn't know that. Now what we know about public education is that K-12 is inadequate. I think that it's clear that at least public education right to get Alaskans going today means starting at least 1 year earlier. There's a lot of science that's both conservative and liberal and in between that supports that notion of early childhood development is huge. And women in the workplace means that there's a lot of, children that are, frankly, are left latchkey kids, and there's a lot of caretaking that needs doing there. We didn't know that there'd be giant public works coming along that are a product of the money. And when they wrote the original Constitution, they said, well, let's just have a vote if it's debt, because they assumed that any public project would mean big one, would require debt. Now it doesn't, because if the money's there, they can throw $100 million at it, and that's why we had bridges to nowhere, and we need to take care of that problem. So there are many other things that
There are.
Have happened.
I'm starting to get your case, and every single thing you bring up just triggers all these thoughts. I want to open up for the listeners at 1-800-478-8255. Our guest is John Havelock. He's advocating for a constitutional convention. We decide this issue every 10 years, and this is the year in November. It'll be on the ballot, yes or no. And John, a former Alaska Attorney General, author of Let's Get It Right, is saying now is the time because money is running our politics too much in the state of Alaska, and times have changed since 1956, was it, when they...
The winter of 55-6.
So it was before Alaska became a state. It was a sales document. And in a lot of cases, it seems that they didn't really have enough time to really think through some of the stuff that they put in the Constitution.
Well, I think they did a heck of a good job, actually. But half a century of change, my goodness. I mean, it's really
so they
time
had no
for
way,
review.
You gave a list, and I was thinking when you said education, they had no way of knowing Molly Hooch even would come along, because that was afterwards.
That's right. They didn't know about Molly Hooch.
So all of a sudden they had to build schools in villages they probably never contemplated. And it went on beyond that also. Would they even have known that education would be the biggest single item in the state budget?
Well, they might have guessed that. But what they would not have guessed is that half a century later, just having a high school degree doesn't equip an Alaska citizen to make his way in the world. You need more than that. You need preschool education, and you need some advantage in going forward, maybe a year or two after, and to be the equivalent of what they were looking at then. I mean, Bill Egan was only a high school graduate, and maybe high school graduates are there, but now you're seeing more and more people with doctorates and
there's all kinds of things. You've got to have a master's degree. Yeah,
that's right.
Absolutely.
And a BA is becoming pretty essential for.
Yeah. But you're talking beyond 4 years just to get a master's.
Yeah.
So our local call in Anchorage at 550-8422. Statewide number is 1-800-478-8255. Email is talk@alaskapublic.org. And it's interesting. It's always interesting to do a show on civics because it's something that simply, I think it's viewed as so boring that it never gets discussed. And that makes it interesting because we're talking about how we make our own politics and how we have our hands on the handles of power. Sometimes we don't realize that we have our hands on it when the time comes and we could actually do something. Let's get down to this permanent fund part. Yeah. What could we do? You say we can enshrine the dividend, the permanent fund dividend. One show that we've tackled in the topic we've tackled in this show a number of times is, are we really doing the right thing with the permanent fund? In other words, how it's invested. Do we really want it being invested in, you know, what Exxon or, you know, various things like that? Could it be invested in things that would still minimize risk but might increase return? Could it be invested? Could it be investment capital for a more sustainable future in some way? And if the permanent fund does grow like it grew exponentially for a while almost, it's lately been kind of stalled, but if the principal of the fund were to grow, its earnings might exceed what would one would want prudently to be paying out to every Alaskan.
Well, the of course, what is paid out depends entirely upon the present time on the legislative choice through legislation. And
but that's the one little genius of what Jay Hammond did is he they wouldn't dare. If we give a piece of it back to the people, they wouldn't dare mess with it.
And, you'd be surprised. you know, the permanent fund, interestingly enough, has no purpose. And I think one of the pieces of the of constitutional invention to add to that would be to give it a purpose. And part of that purpose is was the, and I think it was central to Jay's thinking, was that that it would be a rainy day fund. But there are no standards for when a rainy day occurs. So I'm sort of waiting for, you know.
I remember it was about 1986, 87, when Al Buffon, a local 71, got up there and said, well, it's a rainy day.
That's right.
I'm starting a parade. And he went marching down the street all by himself.
Yeah. So that's the rainy day thing is one thing to do. I think that some sort of calibration of what is a maximum dividend should be set. And that should not be, and that needs a accelerator in it to cover inflation, because I know some people have talked about it. I mean, there are enemies of the permanent fund dividend, as you probably know. You know, people.
Well, they don't dare talk about it in public, but if you get people in private, you get all kinds of.
That's
stuff.
Right. Yeah. They think it's an entitlement, and it gives people these bad attitudes because, well.
Right.
And these are the same people, I might add, that are sitting there drawing down dividends from stuff they inherited from their grandpapa, you know, and they're not particularly deserving people necessarily. So it's these are assets that are owned by the, you know, as Wally Hickel said, it is the owner state. These are assets that are owned by all the people. So I see nothing, not only nothing wrong, but I think it's darn good social policy to distribute a dividend. I mean, it's the reason why I think, you know, the last time I look at the data on it, Alaska has a smaller distinction between the very rich and the very poor of any other state. That is, and that's entirely because the dividend lifts the income of the lower, of the bottom third, bottom half of the income calendar.
Well, John Havelock, we got a call from Robert in Anchorage. Welcome to Talk of Alaska with John Havelock, Robert.
Hi, John. This is Rob Crosman. All of the causes that you talk about as being desirable to open in a constitutional convention are good ones, and I'd like to see changes come about along the lines that you suggest. As you know, there are other political forces in Alaska, big corporate oil, and also the right wing, the Sarah Palin, the Tea Party, and so forth.
And mining. Don't forget mining, Robert.
Oh, and mining. They might love to have a crack at changing the Alaska Constitution in ways that you and I and progressive forces generally wouldn't particularly support. So I'm fearful, as with amending the United States Constitution, of what might be the actual product of opening that Pandora's box.
Well, the bottom line on it is, of course, that the whole people get to vote in the end. That is, the convention doesn't fix a constitution. It makes proposals. I assume it will not be a whole new constitution, but it'll be a proposal for maybe four amendments and three or four ordinances that will be voted upon. So the people in the, as a whole, get to reject these amendments. I wouldn't necessarily, you know, until I hear what is said, I don't think I'm personally prepared to reject any proposal just because some guy is labeled as a Tea Party or whatever. I mean, hey, there are good ideas all over the place. I think Sarah, maybe I'm a beleaguered supporter, but I think Sarah had some pretty good ideas, and the state is lucky to have had her for her two-year governorship. So I wouldn't discount, you know, that. And also, I know this is probably the biggest single answer I hear from people when I say we should have one, is that the crazies are going to take over and the new thing. And what people are thinking about in that is they're thinking about individual rights are going to be impaired in some way. And well, there is a U.S. Constitution, and everything that we do has to be within the scope of that U.S. Constitution. So most of the things that you think about, which are sort of crazy, crazy proposals, are unconstitutional under the U.S. Constitution and are not going to be, therefore, enacted or effective in Alaska.
Well, yeah, that's a very good point. And at least as far as I'd listened, I mean, getting corruption out of government is something that we constantly have to be working toward, because there's the legislature and the government controls money, lots of money, and where there's lots of money, there's opportunities for corruption. How do you get corruption out of or keep it within manageable limits or discourage it with a constitution or a constitutional amendment?
Robert, you just asked one of the key questions, I think. The telephone number 1-800-478-8255, a local call in Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. You betcha. I think one of the elements, John, that you would answer would be the unicameral legislature might be a way of...
I think the unicameral legislature will help, because you're going to have 60 legislators, and that'll help enormously, because districts will be smaller. You won't have as many of these weird districts, maybe no weird districts, because, you know, you combine 40 and 20, you get 60 different districts. People can walk those districts. They're going to be much more in contact with the individual. And I think that's, you know, partly one of the reasons why when the people were allowed to vote on that as an advisory, they voted yes to change to that system.
Yeah, so I guess just to go through the civics 101, you would assume that you might have still 60 legislators, but instead of 40 and 20, it'd be 60, so you could have smaller districts.
Yeah, smaller districts, and you also have in a unicameral legislature far more visibility. How do you know now, you know, where any legislation comes from, and how do you evaluate any legislator's claims? Because there's all these deals going back and forth. The House and the Senate enact different legislation, and then it's settled in a secret conference committee where they come up with some deal, which includes new parts, I might add. You know, there's no restriction that stops them from doing something else. So it's really, you know, they talk about, you know, not wanting to see legislation made just like sausage. Well, that's the worst kind of system in a bicameral. And you know, if we, I mean, just think of the idea, supposing you suggested, hey, you know, the problem with the city of Anchorage is we don't have a bicameral city council. Wouldn't that be fun to have a, sort of a super extra council to sit there and have them go back and forth, and you'd watch the deals go on back and forth. You wouldn't see them. There'd be deals going back. You'd smell them. But it just doesn't make any sense, you know, and it's not like novel. Nebraska's done it already.
And you also point out that, you know, I'm not letting this one alone, but you do point out that at the time of the Constitution Convention, there were fewer people in Alaska than now live in the city of Anchorage.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
And Anchorage has its borough assembly, its municipal
assembly. We all knew each other then, you know, in a way. I mean, frankly, the... you know, in 1959, 60, 61, I knew every lawyer in Alaska, you know, it was, and we all got together for an annual convention, every law firm closed. So it was just a way smaller community, and you had that trust and also the ability to mistrust or to spot wrongdoing.
Now you're getting all misty-eyed and nostalgic, John. We all know we're not going back to those days. As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from First National Bank Alaska, offering business solutions to help Alaska's dreams grow for 90 years. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. For thousands of years, the coastal residents of Arctic Alaska have depended on the polar bear for sustenance, utilitarian, and spiritual purposes. The Alaska Nanook Commission was formed to ensure that current and future Alaska Native subsistence hunters will be able to continue to harvest this important resource. The Alaska Nanook Commission, along with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, would like to hear from subsistence polar bear hunters. Learn more at AlaskaNanookCommission.org. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Nanook Commission.
Here we are, redesigning the Alaska Constitution with John Havelock. John, if I recall correctly, you were part of the creation of the privacy language that was inserted in the Constitution.
That's a good memory, yes. I did. It was my language, although it was done with a Senate leader at the time, a Republican. Incidentally, in those days, I found no problem in working across party lines. I worked with Cliff Groh and Tom Fink and getting stuff done. It was a better climate. And then the privacy amendment, what had happened, Terry Miller was the senator. He's a great man, died young, and maybe they all do. And the Terry, anyway, had a bunch of privacy stuff up, and it was very long, and it was going to mess up bureaucratic things. And so I'd spoken against it, and then this is the way it worked down there. I'm just walking down the hall, and Terry's walking the other way, and he says, John, he says, just, okay, I see your objections. Just give me some language. So I did the privacy amendment the way it now is and gave it back to him, and with administration support, it sailed through. My only, frankly, I would like to fix that now because the I learned purity of language from Tom Stewart, who's one of the delegates and one of the great Alaskans, and he advocated for purity of language. And I thought that the privacy amendment would cover invasions of privacy by corporations and so on, which was one of the big issues of the day because the big corporations were starting to collect data. But I'll admit that I was disappointed in a state Supreme Court decision that says only the government is limited by the Privacy Amendment, which makes it just too much of just an adjunct to the search and seizure clause and not enough broader privacy. So I'd like to see that fixed.
Fascinating. But isn't it possible a convention could do away with it, getting all panicky about drugs and so forth? Or about abortion even?
I suppose that they could, you know, make proposals to do away with anything. But as I say, the people have to vote on these amendments that are going to come out. And the people aren't going to let anything crazy go through, frankly. there may be something that the country would think crazy, like going unicameral, you know, which was too crazy to be considered back in 1955-6 when you're trying to please the Congress.
In a way, we have these checks and balances. You think, like, right now, a nutty idea can get going in one house of the legislature, and certainly has, and right now is in both sides, and they know, the cooler heads know that they can let them just pound away at it, and the other side's just going to block it.
Yeah, and then the governor has a veto on top of that, you know, and then the Supreme Court can say, hey, this is so nutty it violates another constitutional
provision. Well, you have a unicameral legislature, and all of a sudden that's not the case anymore. I can picture it being, you let a logjam loose, John, and an awful lot of water goes down there. Couldn't we just have a legislative diarrhea, so to speak?
I don't think so at this point in our time, because when I look at what's being introduced in legislation now, frankly, it's just not close to what we did in the first couple of decades when we were, you know, building the legal structure for a state. Now it's just small amendments here and there, and I don't see any logjam, and I don't think Nebraska is well known as a hotbed of radical crazy stuff coming out of their legislature and their unicameral.
Yeah. At this point, I think I will, in answer to, I'm sure others who are have already called in and said, you're going to let those crazies take over. I'm going to read from your book here on page 15 of the introduction. Responding to those who fear that terrible things can happen because of all the crazies out there who want to make weird changes or repeal liberties, he said, speaking of Thomas Jefferson. And then you quote Jefferson. I know of no safe depository of the ultimate power of society that the people themselves, but the people themselves, and if we think them not enlightened enough to exercise their control with a wholesome discretion, the remedy is not to take it from them, but to inform their discretion.
Smart guy, that Jefferson.
Well, it bears some thinking about.
Yeah.
As does, if you think of a grand jury, which is helpful to me as a correlative of this, you know, what a grand jury, they generally do have sense. They generally do have sense. And, but how would we know? I mean, people standing for election, it would be popular election. It just seems like it. Do we really know that we would end up with a constitutional convention that would be representative of the people and the wisdom that probably does sit in there in the people somewhere?
In the end, we don't know. We can, but the public can apply their own pressure to provide assurance that the legislature does it right when they draft the bill that will create the constitutional convention. So I think that. And as I say, there have been conventions that have failed. Most of them succeed that have been done by other states. So, and provide improvements. And we've never had a state convention. No, it's half a century. It's and the people are there. The ultimate, as Jefferson says, they're the ultimate deciders in this thing. So, I think that's. Hey, read my book, and you'll see what I think about all this.
The book is Let's Get It Right. All right, let's take up this business of the Inspector General, because you wanted to bring this up. Would this be what's different from, say, an ombudsman or something like that?
Well, let me here the legislature, in its wisdom, did propose a constitutional amendment to set up a judicial conduct commission,
and it has worked sometimes.
And it has worked, the judiciary is in many ways the least likely to offend. but the legislature could pick them on, and the executive could approve that. We don't have any really independent tie on misconduct. And the drafting and enforcement of rules of ethics and moral behavior in
Well, you got the Public Offices Commission. Well, and you got the Legislative Ethics Commission.
The Ethics Commission, that's them deciding their own rules, right? That's the fox writing the rules for the hen house. And, I don't mean the efforts that are made there, but it's look what they let happen, eh? In the legislature, the scandals that everybody knew about, but nobody said anything about. So, so you do need an external force, and I'm suggesting that we. And I also think that the experience with the impeachment of Sheffield impeachment thing, and the consequence of that. I mean, I think it was the Attorney General. I think did a terrific job, as did his deputy. Dan Hickey, in bringing that case before the grand jury. Grand jury said, let's go the impeachment route rather than indictment route, which we know the results of that. But it did underline the fact that it is tough for the Attorney General to bring actions against his own governor, even though he's mandated to do that by his oath of office. So I think that if you have an independent inspector general who is in charge of the of the Public Offices Commission, the chief executive of that, and who maybe also supervises elections. I mean, at the moment, we have our elections are run by the lieutenant governor, who is what? He's a very, you know, one of the most active politicians in the state. You know,
I think many Alaskans would agree that's a problem.
Yeah, so I think if put that into this office and make it a quasi-judicial appointment, or maybe even selection via screening through a grand jury, which is, you know, the bunch of just average citizens coming up. They're not politicians, or, as I say, quasi-judicial, run it somewhat the same way we select judges. So there's options for picking an officer and fixing the budgeting of that state, which is one of the problems of the Public Offices Commission, of course, is their budget can be shrunk by the legislature. So you want to pick it as a percentage of the legislature's budget appropriations to itself.
So this is, you're almost creating a branch of government here.
I will not, I think almost is maybe a little far, but yes, we're creating a somewhat in, but you know, is it a different branch of government than the commission that we have that regulates judicial conduct? It's sort of the same sort of function.
Yeah, and we have to have something like that for public utilities as well.
I have not discussed that, but I think you have a point. Mm-hmm. With it.
But the idea of the inspector general would be the head of this, or
yeah, the inspector general, it is simply, it gives a visibility that and a place where people can come and file their complaints.
Including about the executive branch.
Executive
and legislative. So, for instance, I get people all the time coming to me and saying, you need to do a show about the our management of game in Alaska. It's just totally out of control. They're giving it over to the guides. And I can't find a good way to focus a show on that. But if there were someone in government that was saying, look, this has got way out of balance, there would be a better way to take a look at it than talk radio.
I think that's something to think about, all right. So, yes.
Yeah. Interesting. Let's go to Tom, joins the program from Anchorage. Tom, you're on Talk of Alaska with John Havelock.
Great, thanks. If we have a constitutional convention, we'll have a Tea Party constitution. I can't imagine a worse climate in Alaska for people on the left of the political spectrum as I am and as many public radio listeners are for a constitutional convention. We'll be embroiled in an abortion debate. We'll have an elected attorney general like they do in other states who decides policy by him or herself, such as the attorney generals in states where they're elected now, opting out of the Affordable Care Act, regardless of what the populace thinks. There'll be no protection for retired state workers whose benefits are currently protected in the Constitution. Jefferson doesn't matter now. Glenn Beck matters now. We can't trust the people to stop bad ideas in Alaska. What'll happen is what is happening this very day, where industry makes policy, because this very day, industry is overwhelming the populace on the coastal management issue. It's if there's problems with the Constitution, propose amendments. Don't tear down the whole house. Remodel it.
John?
Well, I agree with that last line about, I'm not suggesting that the whole Constitution be given a new go. Some of the things that the caller suggested would be controlled by the U.S. Constitution, of course. I get around the state a fair amount, and where I go, frankly, I don't see this huge majority of, quote, Tea Party people as, you know, bad guys or whatever. I mean, I think, in fact, there are very few people that I see in Anchorage at Chambers of Commerce or Rotary or wherever that maybe a few that say they're Tea Party. But, you know, maybe there's a third of the population that might get there. The third doesn't pass a constitutional amendment and you know, they're not going to. Sure, they're going to be efforts to fight back, and particularly, you know, the business over coastal zone management is an example of why we need to fix the system, because, you know, we can't keep going through these coastal zone management where the big three oil companies are going to spend the money to control public opinion. I mean, that's why I say the biggest single problem we have is a slip towards oligarchy in the country and in the state. And I think
but Tom's point is, what's to say it wouldn't get worse?
Well, it'll get worse if we don't do anything. I mean, we're only halfway there.
You know? So I guess John's answer is getting worse anyway, Tom.
Well, I believe a constitutional convention will speed the worsening.
All right, Tom. Thanks for your call. I'm sure you're very much not alone out there.
No, you're not. I appreciate your concerns. I just think that sort of as Jefferson says, you know, you got to look to the general public in the end, and we can inform what they're thinking.
Yeah, and I mean I don't think that the left wing has a monopoly on common sense either. Sorry. I just don't think that's the case.
No.
Let's go to the break, and then we'll go to Michael in Anchorage as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from Providence Imaging Center with Drs. Scott Nespinski and Christopher Reed, providing interpretations of imaging studies with a focus on musculoskeletal radiology, provimaging.com. And by the Federal Aviation Administration, setting standards for the operation of aircraft in airports, faa.gov/go/flyalaska, or toll free at 1-866-357-4704. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable donations. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
So many areas to cover in the state constitution in so little time. We're with John Havelock, former attorney general, author of Let's Get It Right, about the possibility of voting yes this time around on having a constitutional convention. It would throw it to the legislature. The legislature would have to come up with a way of having a constitutional convention. The convention wouldn't throw the entire constitution out, probably, but would come up with ideas of how it might be changed in this or that way, and then we would have to vote on those. That's your basic process. But what we could do with this, that is why John has written this book. He thinks some things need to be done to get big money, lessen the impact of big money in the political process. And clearly we're getting a bunch of calls that say, oh, it's liable to make it worse. And John says, well, it's already getting worse. So that's where we sit at this point. John, before we go to Michael's call, let me just ask you quickly, how exactly can a state, when the U.S. Supreme Court has already spoken on Citizens United and corporations having the right to speak in an election process as individuals, as citizens, how could the state constitution address this?
There are two ways that I discuss. One is we could strengthen the disclosure provisions. I mean, now it's kind of a blur. You never really, you know, or really tiny print at the bottom.
We could do that with statute, though, can't we?
Well, who's we? You know, you're talking about a legislature that is, you know, already partially in the pocket of the very interests that want to preserve that. The other thing is reading Citizens United, you find that part of the sort of apologia in there is that the court says, well, you know, shareholders' democracy can take care of these problems. So there's a window for us. And what I'm suggesting is that we pass the provisions that require that before any money is spent by a corporation to influence an election, that they require a vote of it, their shareholders, and that the shareholders have the option of taking a dividend instead of supporting the political expenditure.
I swear to God, it's almost as if the ghost of Jay Hammond just walked into the room here. That is plain out devious.
I think it would. It doesn't cure the whole problem because you still have the Buckley against Vallejo problem about money as politics, and an individual who owns a corporation all by himself at the present time can spend millions. You just have to say every time he says something, it speaks loud that his name is associated with it. You need to do that, which is not the case now. But otherwise, you know, I think you're going to take the big three oil companies out of it with that kind of a provision.
Let's go to Michael, joins the program from Talkeetna. Michael, welcome to Talk of Alaska with John Havelock.
Well, good morning, Mr. Heimel and Mr. Havelock. I just had a couple of quick things I'd kick out there. You know, the Brits did a couple of things to divorce government from the plutocracy, and they one was term limits, and the other was campaign length of campaign. They limit it to 30 days, so you don't have to sell your soul to the devil to run for office. The other thing that just popped up this week about big money is money laundering, and there was an item on Marketplace, which you guys carry, produced by the University of California, and they noted that the guy who wrote this story said, he says the federal government has been pushing for tighter anti-money laundering laws, but there are states like Delaware, Nevada, and Alaska where it is easy to register shell corporations with very little transparency. Anyway, I hope we find the simple solution, and it's not going to be easy, I'm sure. And I really appreciate you gentlemen presenting today. Thank you so much.
All right, Michael.
There's some good suggestions there. You know, I certainly am not the fount of all wisdom, and I expect a lot of good ideas to come up. And sort of addressing what he says about the a couple of those things. I probably am not that in favor of term limits, although it might work with a unicameral legislature because, you know, my experience in watching legislators, it takes them a year to find out where the toilet is. And I think that maybe rules restricting the excessive power of seniority in some other ways might work better, but you know, it's definitely a legitimate question, and there are other ones too that'll work. And the money laundering issue, of course, to be covered by tightening our disclosure provisions, which I don't see this legislature or any near legislature doing.
Joan says, "What's to say that we would get more Native representation this time? We only have one Native in the last constitutional convention. What's to say that we would get more this time around?" And also, I'll throw in a correction here. I think this is true too, John, that you said that Frank Baradovich, the one delegate, was from Metlakatla, but
he's Craig Klawock, I guess.
Klawock.
So yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I knew Frank. He's a terrific guy. Yeah.
What's to say that there would be more than one Native this time around?
Well, you know, you just got to look at what's happened in political power generally. There was no the northern tier of states were all represented by white people in the first legislative session. So with exception, one exception from Barrow, I think the belts, like was the one exception. And I think there's been enormous growth in political sophistication among Native groups, particularly fed by the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which had to be a huge political effort on its own. So there's a strong political consciousness. I think there'll be a representation at least equivalent to their numbers in the state. I don't see that as going to be an issue.
Well, we're running out of time, but I want to get to the redistricting situation. You said earlier this might could be put under that inspector general.
Right.
I think we all see problems with the way we have it set up now.
Right.
And he could say the same thing. The same way that there can be political mischief in redistricting, which has kind of become the rule rather than the exception now, you can also see it in appointments sometimes. Can you address that through the Constitution?
Well,
I could get the appointments like the madness that went on, for instance, that resulted in picking Lisa Murkowski for the Senate, or getting Ted Stevens in the Senate,
right,
for that matter.
Right. I think you can control some of that. I expect to be controlled through the Public Offices Commission as strengthened and becoming part of the Inspector General's regime, and in terms of some of those hijinks. But you know, there's always going to be some political hijinks in politics. Incidentally, the Murkowski matter illustrates, I think that was maybe democracy in action, and it showed, among other things, just how much political power Alaska Native has.
On, but yeah. But the actual appointment process.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't know.
You go and you change the law at the last minute.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that the guy that's leaving the Senate gets to pick his own successor once he gets elected governor?
Yeah. Well, it was, you know, I mean, I agree that there may be ethical constraints that you can control a governor and have been pointing his relatives to things. Quite possibly so. As far as the redistricting problem, you know, in the original Constitution, is the governor appointed a nonpartisan board. The legislature decided that that was not really nonpartisan enough for them or whatever, and so they put through an amendment.
So the Constitution did not constrain them from doing that?
It said it's supposed to be nonpartisan. I think that the Supreme...
So what, did they have to amend the Constitution to do this?
Yes, they amended the Constitution to...
And we okayed that?
Well, that's right.
Fool me once.
It was a sleeper, you know, and it says, I'm trying to make this constitutional convention thing not a sleeper and something that people think about and vote for. But the, I think redistricting is now, you know, is a political process because the Speaker, the House, and the Senate President and the governor all get to appoint people to it. So you don't... come on, guys. I mean, this is terrible. So I suggest that maybe there's a role for the grand jury here to you know, be the place where they go and pick the experts that you need to do this kind of redistricting. In the end, it's a redistricting is a expert process because it's for demographers and so on to figure out how you meet the constitutional measure. So I think that's
state,
an improvement.
Do you think the state should get out from under the Voting Rights Act? Federal?
I guess, yes, I do. Yeah, I do.
Interesting.
That, and I say that because...
well, you have
because,
the experience.
Well,
you have the experience.
I was there. You know, I just don't think that that Alaska now gerrymanders, as it were, to exclude natives, and I don't think they have for a long time. I think it's... we were thrown into it because of some statistical data. You know, things, I'll give you an anecdote here if I got time.
Yeah, you have about 30 seconds. Can you do it?
I knew somebody in the Justice Department when I was AG, and they called me up and they said, hey, we got this, you know, law that provides. And I said, oh, no, there's no problem here now. He says, okay, we'll write it off. So, no.
Very good. All right, the book is entitled "Let's Get It Right," and John Havelock has been our guest. It's been fun, and I hope there's more fora at which you get to put forth your ideas and get it debated, because clearly you have a lot to answer for here, John Havelock.
Well, I'm open to invitations to any forum.
All right, thank you so much,
including the Tea Party.
Yeah, absolutely, and. Sorry for those who we didn't get their comments through. Thanks to Kristen Spock on the phones and to Dave Waldron at the controls. Next week on Talk of Alaska, what if we had unlimited funds to invest in education? Where would you spend it? I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska. A recent statewide survey by Dittman Research showed that 65% of Alaskans think it's time to build the Kinnick Arm Crossing, and 77% of those surveyed believe the bridge will save Alaskans time, money, and provide our economy with needed jobs. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit KinnickArmBridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.